some of these girls, I don't know, maybe Cheryl can help. Just so you have this on your thing so you can remember. Mm-hmm. It's April 11th. And I'm Steve McKinley. And Cheryl McKinley, my favorite wife. The only one that stayed with me. We've been married for nigh unto 38 years. And so she's been through a lot of these things. She's been through everything with me. We were married in 75. And Charlotte was just a baby when we met Ross. And so these older girls, I don't know if you remember much about Ross. I don't remember if you remember being around him or seeing him. Maybe Candace would.
I didn't get to meet him. Candace did.
Candace yeah. remembers him a lot.
I know that when Ross, near the end of his life, he got sick and had to go to the hospital, and he never went back. He had some storage sheds, and Cheryl and I and Stephen, my older son Stephen, went and helped clean out his sheds. I think Karen did too, didn't she? Didn't she go with us and help us do that?
So he was living by himself at the time?
Yes. When I met him, I met Ross in 95. I met Tom in early part of 95, January, somewhere in there. I had heard that there was a family who was getting evicted from a mobile home park in Salt Lake City. And they needed help. And so my son, Stephen, who at that time, how old would Stephen be in 95? What year was he born?
He was born in 78.
14, 15?
Yeah, just a young boy, 14, 15 years old. And he went with me, and we went up there, and we met Tom Green's wife, Linda, and told her who we were and why we were there, and asked if there's anything we could do to help. And she said, well, he went to Vernal, to Jay Slaw's place, to get a truck. Jay is also was an adopted son of Ross. So was Tom Green. That he was coming back to move the double wide. And so Stephen and I started taking it apart, jacking it up and taking undoing all the bolts and taking it all apart. And we worked on that, slept on the floor of that double wide at night. And the next morning, late morning, Tom showed up and said, I'm Tom Green. I understand you've been working on my house. And so we met Tom and helped him get that thing all took apart, and he hooked up with the truck and he went to out to the West Desert with the trailer. And then Tom, along the way, just before he turned off the dirt road, this gentleman who had too many beers, I guess, he was a little bit drunk. And he had one of these one-ton trucks with a flatbed that sticks out a little bit. And he ran into the side of the trailer. And from one end to the next, he just took out the whole wall out of that inside, all the supports, and just wiped out and bent up the trailer a little bit. And Tom finished taking it out to where he was going to put it. And then he called me the next morning, knowing that I had experience with mobile homes, and wondered if I would give him an estimate of what it would take to repair it so the insurance company could pay the repair bill. So I drove out there with Tom, and we had a good conversation about a lot of things. And this was in 95. This was after we had been through the Jim Harmston thing. We'd been through a lot of other things, and maybe I can tell you some of that too, but I'm kind of starting in the middle. But he he and I had some really good conversations because we had a lot of time just driving out there on the dirt roads and everything. And I warned him. I said, you know, I remember we talked, and then he was going to take the second half out. And so I met him, and I drove my pickup truck as a pilot car to help him get the second half out there. And so I followed him out there, and we got out there, and I saw his broken mobile home there, and then the other half. And I said, you really need to get these hooked together, because if you don't, they're just going to roll down this valley like a tumbleweed, because the wind's going to blow them and just roll them down this valley. You need to hook them together, even if it's bent. We can fix that later. But hook it together, and then you'll be all right. Well, just a couple of days after I told him that, and we all went back to Salt Lake. He went to Salt Lake. I came here to Manti. And he called me. He says, well, Steve, you must be a prophet, because both of my trailers are flat. And it blew them over and just leveled them, just flattened them. And he was really sad about it, and so was I. So I spent a little bit of time with him trying to get him situated out there and driving back and forth out there, you know, to these trailers and trying to solve that problem for him or help him with it. And so during those trips, we conversed a lot about a lot of things. He told me about Ross. He told me about it was actually Steve Bjorkman, the father of Karen Bjorkman. Not the father, the husband of Karen Bjorkman, who introduced Tom to Ross in the beginning. And he told me all about that. He told me about Fred Collier. He told me about another fellow, Jerry Barlow. And he gave me the history of his history with Ross and everybody and his point of view. And then I asked him if I could meet Ross. And so sometime in there, I can't remember exact dates or when, but it was after January of 95 and before June of 95. So in there somewhere, I asked if I could meet Ross. And he said, yeah. He said, we usually go to breakfast with Ross at Ogie's. And he said, this is the priesthood meeting. We have priesthood meeting on Sunday morning with Ross at Ogie's. We have breakfast, and we talk about whatever we want to talk about, and we invite people to come, and some people come, and some people come and go. He told me stories. He told me a story of one fellow who came, and he was only interested in questioning Ross, and he wanted to find out if Ross really was a prophet of God, if he really had anything at all. And boy, he was there to really accuse and really find out the truth. And he asked him all these questions, and I remember one question that he asked. He says, so what about tithing? And Ross says, well, how does 5% sound? You know, just pay me 5%. That'll be good enough. And the reason I remember that question is Tom told me that after Tom had went back out to the parking lot with this fellow, he was telling Tom how he knew that Ross could not be a prophet. And he said, everybody knows that tithing is 10%, not 5%. He cannot be a prophet of God. He doesn't have anything at all. And so he went away shaking his head. I remember a fellow met Ross one time, and Ross had people shake hands. Ross would do it like this. He'd go like this. Yeah. So give me your finger.
Okay.
Yeah. And he'd shake hands with you like that.
Right.
Well, this guy was really offended. He thought that Ross was insulting him. And so he went away because of that, because of the handshake, you know. And so Ross got to where he could detect what people were interested in when he'd beat them. And maybe he always had that ability, probably did. Where he could, he knew the intents of people's hearts. And so we go into Ogie's, and Ross and Jerry were already there, and Tom brought me, and so it was Ross and Jerry and Tom. And when I say Ross, I mean Ross Wesley LeBaron. Ross Wesley LeBaron Sr. Not Ross Jr., the guy that lives in cane beds and has sex with his daughters. Not that guy. That's his son. And I've met him too. I've had an association with him. And he's crazier than crazy. And a lot of people, especially online, will get confused between Ross Jr. and Ross Sr. And they'll start thinking that Ross Jr. is the one I'm talking about, and it's not. So I just want to make that really clear up front, that this is Ross Wesley LeBaron Sr. And Ross Jr. is his son.
So that first meeting at Ogie's, there were four people?
Yeah, there were four of us there present. Tom Green, Jerry Barlow, Ross Sr., and myself. And we went in, we sat down, and Tom ordered, and I ordered. They had a special. I ordered the special. I think it was eggs and toast or something. I don't know. It was... Anyway, and so I sat, I still remember, it had like an oval-shaped booth, you know, a table there, and Ross would always sit here on this end where he could get out, in and out, real easy, and Jerry and Tom would circle around, go in behind, scoot behind the table, and I sat out here, kind of, you know, where the walkway is, on a chair, and so it was, you know, like you and I, Ross was here and I was here. And I sat down, and from the start, as soon as I sat down, Ross started teaching me, started telling me his position and his understanding of things. He didn't fool around with a handshake or 5% or any of that stuff. Sometimes people would come and he would talk about kombucha. And you could tell if he really wanted to talk to somebody and really wanted to teach someone, and if they really wanted to learn. Well, I did. I was on a quest. I was on a search, you know. And so I guess he figured that. He felt that. And so he just started talking to me and teaching me, probably trying to find out what I knew and what I didn't know and what I believed and didn't believe. And then breakfast was done, and we weren't done talking. So Jerry Barlow, you know, he did herbal remedies. He had a tincture business, and he had a couple of double-wide mobile homes that he used to bottle his extract and bottle his tinctures. And they were right there in Salt Lake City. Can't remember what town, but it's right near where Ogie's was. So we went over there, and Jerry and Tom, when Ross was talking to me, they first started talking, their jaws just dropped wide open, because they've never experienced him talking to someone like that first time. And so when we got over to the trailers, Ross sat on one of these lawn chairs, and I sat on a 5-gallon bucket right in front of him at his feet, and he's just talking to me and talking to me. And I recall a couple of things. Most of it are things that I had learned and that I knew already, and so we were just going over things, and he was finding out about me and I was finding out about him. And then he turned to me and he said, "Steve, do you know why the planets stay in orbit?" And I've told this story to a lot of people, and some people understand it and some people don't. And that's okay. I don't care. He says, "Steve, do you know why the planets stay in orbit?" And, you know, not wanting to look silly, I said, well, I don't know. Is it gravity? It's probably gravity, because they're attracted to the sun, and the mass keeps them in orbit around the sun. And he said, no, Steve, no. Don't you know why? And I said, no, I don't know why. And he said, because not even God can stop them. And I knew exactly what he meant. That even the planets, because I'd known this for a long time, I felt like even the planets, animals, trees, everything has a spirit, you know. The flood was a baptism for the earth, you know, because it has a spirit. It's made up of matter and intelligence, and it has a spirit. It's a living thing. Not the same, not exactly the same as we are, but nevertheless, it still has a spirit. And for him to say that not even God can stop them just sunk deep into my heart, because I really, really believed in agency, in free agency. I believe that we make our destiny. There's no fate, that we decide what we're going to be and what we can do, and we can change our fate or our destiny by what we do, what we choose. And God gives us the freedom to choose. And I had learned this principle twice, and maybe we'll get to talking to that later on, but I had learned this principle of free agency, and it had been dear to my heart forever. And I really struggled. That's what really made it difficult for me, being a member of the church and having them dictate to me what to do and not to do. Because I felt like that I could ask God, and God would tell me, and then I could choose. Because every time I asked God for things, he would give me ideas, and I'd say, okay, so which one do you think I should do? And he says, Steve, which one do you think you should do? You know, you can choose, you can decide, and let me know how it goes, and I'll help you with the consequences. No matter what you choose, I'm your Heavenly Father. And I love you, and I'll help you deal with whatever you choose, because that's the way it is. So I developed a relationship with my Heavenly Father at a young age, and the things that, when Ross told me that, it just struck a chord with me. It was just, I knew it was true. And then he talked about some more things that I can't really remember, but then he said something. He said, Steve, he said, do you know why I hold the position that I do? And I said, no. I said, it's certainly not gravity. And he smiled. And he said, no. He said, it's because no one except for Jesus Christ fought harder in the pre-existence on the side of free agency than I did. And whether it was by his voice or by someone else telling me of experiences that they had experienced with him, an observation of how he lived his life, that was true. He never took anyone's agency from them. He never expected anyone to do what he wanted them to do. He would teach them, and with patience and gentleness and meekness. Unless you're a real jerk, and then he didn't have time for you, he'd talk about kombucha or, you know, some other thing. And I look at some of these objections that some of the people that followed Ross at one time and then went away, because I've known a lot of them, I see that he allowed them their agency to go and make mistakes. And he didn't condemn them. In fact, I remember Tom Green telling me about an experience that he had with Ross and Fred Collier. Fred wanted to go off and build a church. And Tom said, we're not supposed to do that. That's not right. We're not, you know, and we got to go save Fred. We got to do something about Fred. And Ross said, no, under free agency, he can do whatever he wants to do. he's free to choose whatever he wants, and he'll learn and he'll grow from it. And so if it's of God, then God will bless it, and if it's not, then God will help him after he figures it out. So we don't need to worry about Fred. Let God worry about Fred. Fred made choices. He has a right to do that. And I saw him accept people's right to choose. I remember, and Ross was still alive. I remember one time when in June of 95, probably in early June, May, I'd prayed and I asked Tom to ask Ross where I fit in his family, in his patriarchal family. And I understood patriarchal priesthood. I didn't understand it as clearly as what Ross taught me about it. And it's not, I understood the meaning of the word preside from Ross. And I understood the meaning of section 121 from Ross, that no power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, except on the principles of righteousness. And then the Lord lists them. And so, and virtue, you know, let virtue garnish your thoughts unceasingly. And it's, I've heard some people give blessings and they say by the authority and virtue of the priesthood, or by the power and virtue, or, and I'm like, okay, you can have the authority of the priesthood but lack virtue. And if you lack virtue, then really you lack authority. Because it's only by virtue that you can exercise the priesthood. And I learned that from Ross, that virtue was the preeminent thing that governed priesthood. And Ross had his issues. He was a man just like anybody else. He had his weaknesses and shortcomings just like anyone else, and he'd be the first one to tell you. And he probably knew more about him than anybody else knew about him. And let me back up. I got off track. I'll get back on track, and then I'll get off track again and have to get back on, because I do that. So then somewhere in there, Tom had come to my house, and we were having dinner, and it was after Tom had ordained me. And I said, well, you're my patriarchal father. You can sit at the head of the table. And, you know, you preside. And so you can sit at the head of the table. And he said, well, Steve, I'll sit here, but... No, he said, well, let me sit at the other end of the table. And let me tell you something that my father, Ross, taught me. He said, when he came to my house once and had dinner, and I invited him to sit at the head of the table. And he said, I don't preside over you in your house. I don't preside over your home. You preside here. You know, you sit at the head of the table. You preside. I don't. And Tom told me the same thing here. And I said, okay, then, sit at the foot. And I'll sit at the head. And you can support me. And help me preside righteously in my family. And so that was a principle that Ross had taught Tom, and Tom taught it to me. And I understood that from Ross in my other experiences with him, that this right to preside meant that he, like Christ, came to serve, not to be served. He was a servant. whosoever would be the greatest would be the least. And that impressed me, and everything that I saw in Ross's life. I also recall a time when Tom Green decided to go out there to Greenhaven and had, you know, go out there to the West Desert and take his family out there, and Ross was just really opposed to it and really chastised Tom and said, "You can't do that. Your family will have a hard time, and don't do that. It's the wrong thing to do."
And that's on the boat somewhere.
And he was really upset about it. And so Tom went home that night and came back to see Ross the next morning. Ross was all happy. And he said, "You know," he said, "I've got a revelation. I have a revelation for you. The Lord told me what the name of your place should be. It should be called Greenhaven, because it will be a haven for the Green family. And the Lord gave me this revelation so that I would feel better about you going there." And so, even though Ross may have not been happy with the decision that Tom made, the Lord taught Ross that, or re-emphasized to Ross that Tom had the right to do that, and that he should support his son. And not only that, he gave him the name. Oops, you better pause that for a minute.